ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more. You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, Selena Green with you, bringing you this very last Country Hour of 2025. Thanks for checking in from wherever you're spending your New Year's Eve. Hopefully it's somewhere relaxing, if you're taking a bit of a summer break, or maybe you're busy at work today. Maybe you're out on the header, because I know some of you are still out wrapping up your harvest. I am going to chat to one farmer who's out doing that today about what kind of year he's had and what he hopes for 2026. So that's the question I'd love to put out to you today. Let's get our wish list in for 2026. What do you want it to bring? Now, that could be more rain at the right time, better grain prices, or for livestock prices to stay strong. Maybe something completely different. What do you want out of 2026 for your farm? Let me know. Let's put it out into the universe today. You can call me on my talkback number, which is 1300 160222, or text me 0467 922783. Also coming up, it's been another dry year for the southern Murray-Darling Basin. So what has that done for the price of water?
We've seen a massive increase in permanent plantings over the last decade, most of them without entitlements. Those trees are starting to get older and bigger and demanding more water. So a combination of lower supply and increasing demand has seen the price sort of starting to head up.
I'll bring you that story shortly. But first today, let's start off by heading to a part of the state that has had another extremely dry year, and that is the Mallee. Now, throughout the year, we've been hearing from farmers in the district about how challenging the lack of rain and the strong winds have been for what as many has been our third season, at least in a row. One farmer put down his razor in April and pledged not to pick it up again until the drought broke. That's Wakery farmer Tim Paschke. Tim, happy new year. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I've seen the pictures, the updates throughout the year of the beard situation. The plan was to keep that on until the break came. Unfortunately, it does look like you're rolling into 2026. The beard is still very much coming with you.
Yeah, look, I think why not? It's there's a few members of my family that don't like it, but I think it's we'll call it the beard of hope for 2026, I reckon.
So I mean, I wish that, you know, it had been a different situation and the rains had come and you'd been going into the new year clean face, but it has, we should admit, a very dry year for you there, unfortunately.
Yeah, look, it's been one of the, it wasn't really just even the dry, it was the wind that was connected, and that, you know, we're still harvesting at the moment just because we've had to really reduce our speed for harvesting, and so it's taken a bit longer, and we're just hopeful that that the next year brings timely rain, I suppose, because we'll be in a world of pain otherwise.
I've been seeing some photos and images of what, you know, just how much soil and sand and everything has been blown around there in the past few months. So just describe how bad that wind has been and just how much it's been moving.
Look, even last night we had a wind event, the cool change blew in and it blew, you know, for 5 or 6 hours. Again, there's dust blowing everywhere. We're talking millions of tons of dirt, I suppose. You know, we've got fences that we have to, you know, start working on and you know, with probably 3 or 4 weeks of grading there and then just the damage to our paddocks, scalloped out wheel tracks, you know, some are over, you know, 2 foot deep, I suppose, and just a lot of dirt to be moved back into place. And the problem is a lot of the paddocks will have to probably be reworked, just because the way we farm with direct drilling and no-till and trying to retain cover has actually caused us nearly more problems where the dirt's actually blown into those sections and have made bumps. So that's why the paddocks are so rough. In the old days, they would have swept, the paddocks would have swept and been quite flat. And, but now, it's caused another problem. But in saying that, without the way we farm, I wouldn't be even reaping a crop. So, you know, there's a catch 22, I suppose. Mm. But there's months of work ahead of us, and that's on top of everything we do already. And it's just like, oh, I don't know how we fit all that in, but that's all right. That's what we do the job for.
So obviously that slows the process down. So where are you sort of at in terms of getting through your harvesting, and how does that compare to where you'd like to normally be around the 31st of December?
Oh, look, I'd rather be at the river having a beer at this time of the year. We're only 2 or 3 days away from completion. We always love to be finished before Christmas. Generally, you know, the last couple of years we've been finished, you know, well before December. And that suits us really well because then we can get our summer program of spraying under control and things like that. But this year it's just, you know, it's just the fact we can, instead of reaping 160 hectares a day, we reap 100 because of just the speed. We don't break too much going a bit slower. So I guess that's why we do it. So.
I guess, as you mentioned before, one of the bonuses is you have been able to get a crop up despite everything.
Yeah, look, it's well below average. You know, we're probably averaging around the 0.5, which is, 2.5 bags or whatever over the acreage. But, you know, and that's at least half of our break-even price. So I guess we're not going 100% backwards, but it is a bit frustrating driving around and knowing we're not actually making enough money to cover our costs. And that's heartbreaking as well. But, you know, look, going into next year, a new year offers new hope, I suppose. And that's the difference between us and someone like the great guys at the moment. Next year can be completely different for us, where, when you look at, supply and demand of certain things, there's some people don't have that, we'll still, our commodity is still always going to be sought after. So, that's a real blessing in itself. But hopefully it can rain this, the middle of March, and we can get some sheep feed in, and, things can start ticking along, and hopefully we can get a germination instead of dry seeding everything, and that would be wonderful. So.
Absolutely. I think that's the definite wish for 2026, is just to finally get that good season that has been elusive for a few years now. Do you have a figure? Do you have a date? Do you have sort of a goal to say, yeah, this is, we'll get this and the beard's coming off?
Yeah, look, it was always 25 mil. I don't know whether I should actually reduce my estimates this year or not. But it was 25 mil in a rain event, and that could be over a week, I suppose, if it was, the ground can stay dry, stay wet, and we can get a decent break, I suppose. But that's, that's sort of what we need. We need a target of that. The ground's so dry, we have no subsoil moisture, and that's sort of the minimum almost for us. So hopefully that's sort of the number, and maybe I should stick with it. I don't know. Maybe I should lower my expectations. Maybe I'll be a lot happier then.
Maybe you've grown attached to the beard.
Well, I don't hate it, but I think it might become my mechanic always said, if it gets to my belly button, I should probably go and buy a Harley. And I said, mate, if it gets to my belly button, I ain't got any money to buy a Harley, so I'll be broke by then. But, we're hopeful that, hopefully by the Anzac Day, I can all be fresh, and it'll only be a year since I started growing it. So, it'll be fine. It's just different care. I don't understand women's hair a lot of the time, but the beard, you've got to shampoo it and you've got to comb it.
You've got to look after it.
You've got to look after it. So it's another 5 minutes in the shower now. So.
Well, I am hoping, and everyone I think listening, Tim, will be hoping for you and all the farmers around your district that 2026 brings those rains, and it is a much better season than what you've endured this year and the previous years as well. And hopefully you'll be having that beer by the river very, very soon. All the best for the remainder of your harvest.
Thanks for having me.
Wakery farmer Tim Paschke there. It is 14 minutes past 12.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
With Selena Green on this New Year's Eve. Well, the temporary water market is eyeing $400 a megalitre as dry conditions continue across the southern Murray-Darling Basin. Rural Co Water General Manager Phil Graham says the market is tighter due to several factors, including more permanent plantings and the Commonwealth actively buying water.
Temporary market on the Murray below choke is currently 380, 385. Over in the Goulburn, it's 370, 375, and across in the Murrumbidgee, 375. And above choke, it's a little bit cheaper on the Murray. It's about 310, 320. But, yeah, certainly we've had a bit of a dry run. Storages are lower, a fair bit lower than this time last year. And allocations are lower. So over in the Goulburn, we're still only on 69%. And in New South Wales, Murray General's only on 20% and the Bidgee's General's only on 32%. So, yeah, certainly much drier and lower allocations than what we've seen the last, you know, 4 or 5 years.
What would you say is pushing those prices northwards?
It is just the lack of supply, so the allocations are lower, so that creates less supply in the market. At the same time, you know, demand is reasonably strong, particularly in the Murray below choke, because of, you know, we've seen a massive increase in permanent plantings over the last decade, most of them without entitlements. Those trees are starting to get older and bigger and demanding more water. So a combination of lower supply and increasing demand has seen the price sort of starting to head up.
Speaking of permanent plantings and then also the permanent water market, what is that doing at the moment?
It's a bit of a two-tiered market, I must admit. So the Commonwealth are active in the market purchasing water for the environment via some tenders and expressions of interest they did in 2024, so they're still just sort of working through them, and you know they're paying prices which is significantly higher than the private everyday market. In terms of the private everyday market, it is increasing a little bit. We're up to about 8 in SA and 7,800 in Vic and 9,000 per meg in New South Wales. So it is creeping up, but you know there's not a lot of investor activity in that market. The returns haven't been great over the last few years, and similarly there's not a lot of irrigators that have the capital available to purchase permanent water at the moment as well. So whilst the temporary price is going up, we haven't necessarily seen that translate into permanent prices just yet.
Casting an eye towards the future, which is always dangerous territory to try and predict such an uncertain area. So what do you expect people are thinking about leaving 2025 and heading into 2026?
Certainly, you know, I think there's enough water in the system such that temporary prices shouldn't run away dramatically for the rest of this year. You know, there was a lot of carryover, and whilst allocations are lower, you know, they're still okay. So whilst we might see prices sort of, you know, continue to chip up a little bit, it shouldn't run away dramatically. I guess the big risk and the big fear is the unknown for the 2026-27 water year. As I said, storages are a fair bit lower. Thank God we've got water in Menindee this year, but as you know, that doesn't last that long due to evaporation. So the real risk that irrigators need to start thinking about is the following water year, and perhaps getting some cover in terms of forwards or leases or purchasing a bit of carryover just to try and perhaps hedge a bit of risk there.
That's Rural Co's Water General Manager Phil Graham speaking with Timu King. It's 18 minutes past 12. Well, we've been asking our wonderful team of rural reporters to look back at some of the biggest stories they've covered in their local patch in 2025. So as we round out the year, let's head to the state's north and west, where our reporter Isabella Kelly has been casting her eye back over the year that's been.
There's no denying it's been another incredibly difficult year for farmers across our state's north and west. Record low rainfall, skyrocketing costs, and significant biosecurity issues are just some of the challenges South Australia has seen in 2025. Feed became near impossible to source at times, which inspired a record charity hay run in July. More than 80 truck drivers trekked from Western Australia across the Nullarbor Plain to deliver over 6,000 bales of feed. Truckee and Loading Logistics Coordinator Peter Warburton said the feed would help more than 400 farming families.
On average, most trucks are taking between 60 and 63 bales, 64 bales of hay. And it's not just hay for the livestock, it's also for the farmers over there that say that there's people out there that care for them and want to help them, and that's what it's all about. It's not just as much helping the livestock, it's helping the people that are on the land over there. It's pretty grim to see what's going on over there. Yeah, they've had rain, but it's green as a look at. It's certainly not green for sheep feed or cow feed.
Loading Logistics Coordinator Peter Warburton. Charity runs like this brought both practical support and hope to South Australians. But feed access remained an issue, and people had to get creative. People like Peterborough local Bridget Woods, who spent around $80,000 of her own superannuation to start a community fodder sharing model.
A lot of people have only got small numbers of stock left, and the sourcing of hay, you know, even getting a semi-load of hay out, the cost behind that at the moment is astronomical. And if you've only got a few cattle or sheep left, you don't need a full semi-load. So the idea was to source it and then people be able to share in loads getting it in, because the charities, you know, they drop off 4 or 5 bales to this one and that one, which is absolutely wonderful and much needed, but it doesn't fix the problem long term. So the sharing of loads is a solution that can work long term.
Producer Bridget Woods. Well, livestock producers in the far north were facing their own challenge this year, a flood without a ferry. The Cooper Creek ferry had been taken out for servicing 2 years ago and was yet to be replaced when the Cooper Creek cut across the Birdsville track this year. Sharon Oldfield, who runs a station in the area, said landholders were unable to move livestock without the ferry.
Business margins are very tight, and we believe that we should have access to our market, traditional market still, which is to South Australia. So we've been in negotiations with the state government to ask them to put something in place that we can use for road transport, to continue our road transport of livestock so that we can conduct our business.
Pastoralist Sharon Oldfield. And after months of hoping, a joint federal and state government funded barge hit the water in November. David Bell from Dalkin Inner Station welcomed the solution.
It's a game changer for us. Like, we've had a barge that was just absolutely inadequate before that. Ferry that was here was basically useless. You could put a car and a camper trailer on it. So it did nothing to help support the businesses on the northern side of the Cooper and things like that. So this is just a game changer. It changes our whole aspect of how we can get back to managing our properties when these flood events happen.
Dalkin Inner Station's David Bell. Other good news for the state's producers came in October, when South Australia was officially declared free of tomato brown rugose fruit virus. The virus was first detected in August 2024 in the Adelaide Plains, and that was the first detection of the virus in Australia. And that saw 3 tomato-growing businesses shut down and hundreds of jobs lost in an attempt to contain the highly contagious virus. Horticulture consultant Kingsley Songer said there were lessons for the industry to learn from the outbreak.
Yes, unfortunately there's some casualties along the way, but I'm not sure how you ever avoid that in a situation like this. I think over the years we've seen a deterioration of the testing regimes in Australia in a lot of areas because of the cost of keeping those facilities going and whatever. But you would hope, based on where we've been with this, the tomato virus, that we're going to be in a position that we'll be able to continue to do testing that, you know, wasn't available to us before the virus. What it has done is alerted growers, but also government entities, you know, PIRSA and their counterparts in the eastern states, that, you know, we do need to be on the alert for this type of thing getting into our production areas. We just need to be on top of this so we don't get in a situation where we do have areas like the Northern Adelaide Plains that were so badly hit with the tomato virus. So if there is a silver lining, maybe we're going to see a tightening of some of this testing.
Horticulture consultant Kingsley Songer. And another big biosecurity story this year, which is continuing to unfold, has been the steady spread of varroa mite. Having previously been detected in New South Wales, Victoria, the ACT and Queensland, the parasite, which is deadly to bees, was found in the Riverland early September. It's since been detected in 9 areas around South Australia, and there are concerns it could be particularly devastating for Kangaroo Island. Sharon Simmons from Clifford's Honey Farm says the island is home to the world's oldest bee sanctuary and the purest strain of Ligurian bees.
Well, varroa does wipe out bees by weakening them and then also spreading other diseases that can kill the bees. So the population of bees on the island, it would wipe out a lot of the bees that are here and make it very hard to continue beekeeping. It would be a big threat to the bees that we have on the island.
Kangaroo Island Ligurian Bee Co. Director Brenton Davis says it's another stress for an area which is still recovering from the 2020 bushfires.
In the bushfires, we lost nearly 600 hives. There are over 2,000 hives, so nearly half of the hives on Kangaroo Island were burnt in the bushfires. And then 70% of the vegetation on the island was burnt. It's the high rainfall end that was burnt, so it's the most productive. And that takes 7 to 10 years to recover after the fire. So it's all growing back nicely, lots of leaves and branches and stuff, but the nectar production hasn't happened yet, and we're hanging out a few more years before we get back to full production. We're currently averaging about a third of the production we were before the bushfires.
But things may be looking up for some after late rain saw harvest vastly improve from last year for most farmers, including Richard Way, who farms on the York Peninsula.
Very, very dry start, and in July we had a bit of rain, and then there wasn't much after that. But considering all of that, our yields have been fairly spectacular, really. Far better than last year, and who knows what might happen if we actually have a normal year with a normal break, which we haven't had for, I reckon, at least 5 or 10 years.
Like the rest of the state, the North and West will be heading into 2026 with hopes of a higher rainfall above all else.
That's our North and West Rural reporter Isabella Kelly giving us an oversight into some of the top stories from her region in 2025. Right now, it's just going on 26 minutes past 12. And this could
get on. Sunday, join ABC Sport for the fifth Ashes Test between Australia and England. Hear every ball of the cricket all summer long.
The Ashes.
On your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
Selena Green bringing you the Country Hour today. Let's head to the Weather Bureau now, and Ursula Connor is our forecaster today. Hi, Ursula.
Hi, Selena. How are you going?
Very good. And, well, for the last time in 2025, what is the weather delivering to us?
Yeah, well, quite a fine day across most of South Australia at the moment. We're largely dominated by a high-pressure system which is moving just south of the Bight today. So that's maintaining a ridge over the state, bringing some slightly cooler than average southeasterly winds through most of the state today. A little bit fresh through the coastal areas. But fairly clear skies for most places. And just looking at the temperatures here, we're in the sort of high teens to low 20s through most of the southern parts of the state, and then up there to around 30 degrees as we move through those northern districts there. In the north, we do have a little bit of patchy cloud just streaming across as a result of a little bit of a trough that's lying through the area. So up there, we could see the chance of an afternoon shower or even thunderstorm close to the northern border, but elsewhere across the state, not expecting anything in the way of rainfall. And it's really a similar story as we move into most of the next week. We're going to be very ridge dominated and quite settled through southern parts of the state. The trough lingering in the north for the next few days, although we're really not likely to see too much in the way of rainfall out of that. Just a couple isolated spots, maybe picking up a few millimetres and a little bit more in a thunderstorm, but largely settled and sunny conditions for the next few days and into early next week, starting to see a little bit of heat building potentially as the next high-pressure system moves through. Any rain, as I said, will generally be in the north as a result of that trough producing isolated showers and storms, but we're generally looking at less than 2 millimetres, maybe some isolated higher totals of sort of 2 to 10 with a thunderstorm, but a little bit of uncertainty in that as we move into sort of the weekend and we see where sort of ex-tropical cyclone Hayley tracks. And whether that's going to drag down a little bit more tropical moisture, which could result in those sort of higher totals around 10 millimetres. But largely talking, not too much in the way of rainfall for the next week, Selena.
All right. Thanks, Ursula. Have a happy new year.
You too. Bye.
Ursula Connor there, our forecaster today at the Weather Bureau. So let's look at the western inland parts of New South Wales for New Year's Day. The upper western district expecting a sunny day with a chance of a thunderstorm in the northeast in the evening. Winds south to southeasterlies, 20 to 30 k's an hour, sending south to southwesterly, 15 to 25 k's an hour in the early afternoon, with overnight temperatures falling between 19 and 24 degrees and during the day reaching the mid to high 30s. For the lower western district, a sunny day is forecast with southerly winds 15 to 25 k's an hour becoming light in the late evening. Overnight temperatures falling between 11 and 17 degrees with daytime temperatures reaching somewhere in the low to mid 30s. It's just coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour.
Costa here with a treat for our junior green thumbs, full of tips, tricks and fun.
Grow something amazing!
Gardening Australia Junior is back Friday, January the 2nd on ABC Kids and ABC iView.
The Country Hour, celebrating 80 years in 2025.
Hi, I'm Jackson from Lamoureux. Happy 80th birthday to The Country Hour.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's here until 1 o'clock for you today. We're going to talk fruit fly in this next half an hour. I know there's plenty of regions that are still battling with outbreaks. Some have been able to come out of those restrictions in recent months, but still plenty parts of South Australia where fruit fly is still very much a pesky issue. One location is riddled with fruit fly and locals there are desperate to find a way out of it. Plus, you'll meet one of South Australia's young Haywire competition winners who wants to highlight the impact of dodgy phone and internet reception in the bush, a story I think that many of you are very familiar with.
I think it's just to show that people in regional areas aren't isolated in these issues. Obviously, this has impacted so many people across Australia, and to know that other people have reached out and said, you know, hey, I've experienced this as well is really quite powerful, I think.
I'll bring you that story very shortly, but first, to news headlines with Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, MFS firefighters are set for a 10.5% pay increase over 3 years. With a new enterprise agreement reached, almost 90% of firefighters voted in favour of the state government's proposed pay increase after months of negotiations. Surf Life Saving SA says while enrolments in the VAC swim program are improving, they're still down about 14% on this time last year, most notably on beaches. There was an unprecedented spike in water safety incidents across the state's coast on Monday, which resulted in 43 rescues, and tens of thousands of revelers are expected to flock to Glenelg, Brighton and Semaphore to see the New Year's Eve fireworks displays. Large crowds are also expected along the Adelaide Riverbank at Adelaide Oval and Elder Park, as well as in regional centres like Victor Harbour and Wallaroo. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. I was asking earlier today to send through your 2026 wish list. I said 2027 there, jumping ahead of myself. What is it that you want out of the next year if we're putting it out there in the universe? This one's just for Robin Cowell, and his text simply says, my wish for 2026 is a Liberal government. Well, we'll wait and see because we are heading, as you may well know, into an election year. So that will be something keeping us very, very busy in the coming months. No doubt, strap in for another state election. Now, 20 years ago, you couldn't find a fruit fly in Broken Hill. Now they're everywhere, apparently. Fruit fly entomologist Andrew Jessop says it's now almost impossible to grow something in Broken Hill without finding a fruit fly in it. He recently held a second fruit fly workshop in the city where he said locals are asking a lot of questions about how to win an ongoing war with fruit fly that's obviously causing a lot of anger and anguish.
The obviously the main one is how to get rid of fruit fly out of their backyard. And the other one important is how to get rid of them without using harmful or destructive pesticides. And there are things like organically approved baits, traps, netting, and so forth that you don't need pesticides to any great extent. So there are options. But there's always complaints about neighbours or abandoned orchards and things like that which act as reservoirs for fruit fly, which cause problems for everyone. And that's another question that they ask. How do we manage those sort of areas?
And how much of a problem is fruit fly in Broken Hill?
It's quite a large problem. Over the last 20 years or so, it's gone from pretty much zero to the point where you can't even grow a peach or a tomato that doesn't have fruit fly in it. And it's caused a lot of anger and anguish with the growers, particularly home gardeners, where you can't even have a nice tomato from your own garden anymore without covering it with a net or putting pesticides on it.
You've been studying this for over 40 years, you mentioned. Do you have any inkling or idea of why it's gone from zero to quite prevalent in 20 years?
It's a mixture of several things. One of the most important things is that commercial growers used to be able to use certain pesticides which have now been banned because of their damage to the environment and to the health of the community. And at the same time, we had changes in the weather. Whether it's man-made weather or not, but there has been more rain in the summertime in this sort of area every now and then during La Nina events than normal, and those conditions create a lot of weed growth, humidity, moisture and relative coolness compared to what it should be, and that's paradise for fruit flies under those conditions. So we've had weather, pesticides that aren't used anymore, restrictions on the use of those chemicals for home gardeners, and the fly, once it gets into an area, it's really hard to get back out, to eradicate. So it learns to survive in these new conditions and create havoc.
So fruit flies, how difficult it can be to manage or how bad an outbreak is in 1 year beyond the conditions of the weather, what are we looking like for this year, do you think, in terms of fruit flies in Broken Hill?
At the moment, all throughout southeast Australia, the fruit fly population is relatively low. We've had cooler temperatures and with the odd, very odd hot day, which also controls them, but we've had low humidity and so forth too. So the population is not expanding as quickly at the moment. But if we do have rains after Christmas during January, it may increase. So the population that's bumbling along at the bottom at the moment will increase rapidly if there are good conditions, particularly when fruit start to ripen. If we have a normal Broken Hill summer of very hot days, 40 degrees with low humidity, 30-40%, that will reduce the population somewhat. But in home gardens which are watered, or golf courses which are irrigated, they will become havens for fruit fly to spread from there. So people really should have traps out to check for fruit fly expansion, or at least the presence of them, using some traps.
And if there was one thing you could say to a home gardener with fruit trees or a farmer with an orchard to do this season for fruit flies, what would it be?
I would be monitoring the fruit regularly, particularly if I'm a grower, with traps and for manual inspection of the fruit. Look at the fruit, looking for sting marks and fruit fly damage. Make sure you've got some fruit fly baits ready to apply when fruit flies go into the traps or you find infestations. For home gardeners, there's not a lot of opportunities for pesticides to be used, so I would invest in some netting to cover particularly valuable crops for you and so forth. So netting is good, and also monitor fruits in your yard too. I might add also that you might keep an eye on fruit that's growing outside of your property on roadsides, creek banks and so forth. Make sure that the council is aware of them and let them know that that to get rid of fruit fly from an area, you have to also maintain the self-sown and feral crops that are on the landscape.
That's fruit fly entomologist Andrew Jessop speaking with Christina Rosengren in Broken Hill. And you could read more about this story on abc.net.au/rural. It's 22 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Well, farming waste may soon be utilised to create furniture and build houses. Waste from crops, including hemp, corn, rice and sugarcane, is being tested to become renewable material for use in furniture and houses, rather than being burned or simply discarded. Research fellow at the University of Melbourne, Dr. Benoit Belleville, explains the research.
Well, our research has been looking at a few different crops. So notably, we've been looking at industrial hemp and also corn, so corn stalk.
And how have the initial results been? Are these resources that can be used to successfully make furniture here in Australia?
Yes. Well, we have some very promising results. So we've been looking at different applications, not only furniture, but also looking at building products. And with some testing, we have some very promising results when it comes to acoustic properties, sound absorption properties, also insulation. So these crops have lower densities than you would see for timber, for example. So this can be an advantage where we can use them for different applications in your house. This can also be used for furniture applications. We've done some combinations of different materials using industrial hemp, but also the corn stalk to fabricate some cores for panels, which we can then laminate with different veneers or other materials, depending on the end application, the end use.
So is it difficult to turn these farm waste substances, the corn, the hemp, into the right, resources to make this furniture? Is it a difficult process?
Well, what we do, so obviously we go to the field. Once the crops have been harvested, so for example, for industrial hemp, this is essentially grown to produce seeds, which will then be used to produce oil and other pharmaceutical products. Then we have the rest of the plant, the stalk, the herd, which we break down into smaller particles, smaller bits, and we do an assessment of those of that raw material. We control, obviously, moisture in it. We assess it based on the different provenances, where it comes from. And once we break it down into some smaller, manageable fractions, particles, we can then mix them with different binders or glues, if you prefer, to produce panels for various applications.
And in, as you said, a few different uses you've trialed, were any of them more successful than the others?
We've been able to produce some good particle boards. So these are panel products. So this panel can then be used for multiple applications in your house, in buildings. But yeah, we've done some good trials to fabricate panels, and we also have we're working with our partners to develop some end users for them at the moment as we speak.
So you've essentially proved it's possible. Is it going to be commercially viable? Is this something that Australians might see more often in the coming years?
Well, it's hard to put a time frame on this. So obviously we need to do a bit more research. We're looking at improving the different properties, finding the right recipes, if I can say. So yes, there's a bit more research that needs to be done, but we have some very promising results, and this is something we're doing with our partners, so trying to go from the laboratory to a manufacturing process, also scaling it up. There is obviously some research that needs to be done, but what we get in our lab is very promising. So hopefully fairly soon we'll see some of those products in different markets.
Just to take a step back, why actually look into this as a topic? Why could farm waste be looked to instead of using, you know, Australia has quite a big timber industry? What's the benefit of the research?
One is obviously to reduce our reliance on virgin wood fiber. So obviously the objective is not to replace all the other building materials currently available, but this is to offer an alternative, another option, which can then be used. Looking more specifically into industrial hemp, this is a plant that grows very quickly. So within 90 to 120 days, you get a plant that will be up to 2 meters tall. And this is capturing a lot of carbon as it's growing. So the carbon is then held into those particles, and if you use it in the product, then you keep that carbon inside the product. So that's another advantage. So it's not only sustainable, it's also renewable, and this can be used in, if we look at hemp, we have when we're producing the seeds and we extract them, we're left with 90% of the plant. But this plant has some very good fibers, very long fibers, which have excellent properties, so can be used for many many applications. So trying to use it instead of just discarding it, so using a waste, essentially, from an agricultural waste, and turn it into a high-value product.
Always great to hear about clever ways of utilising what otherwise would be a waste product. That's Dr. Benoit Belleville from the University of Melbourne, speaking there with Elsie Adamo. 16 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Selena Green bringing you The Country Hour today. Well, winners of the ABC's annual Haywire Storytelling Competition were announced in early December, with young people from right across the country sharing candid accounts of what life is like beyond the capital cities. We've been sharing some of the stories of the South Australian winners, and you'll continue to hear those as we head into the new year. Today we head to the York Peninsula for another of our South Australian-based winners. Rhys, he lives on a farm in Sandilands, 20 minutes from Maitland, and in his Haywire entry, he wrote about how the shutdown of a 3G tower has meant internet and phone coverage on his farm is worse than ever, so he decided to do something about it. He also spoke about a new thing for Maitland that's kicked in this year. Rhys goes to classes at both the public and the private school in town because there's not enough students to fill up classrooms in town. I caught up with Rhys after he was announced as one of the winners and asked him, well, firstly, how he felt being chosen.
When I heard the news, I was stunned at first, but then as the realisation kicked in, I think, you know, I was proud to share my story at a national level.
What prompted you to sign up for Haywire in the first place? What were you hoping to get out of the whole experience?
Well, I think just to advocate for regional Australia, and particularly my community here on the York Peninsula. And in regards to the recent 3G shutdown and how it's impacted me as a student, and to show that the government's or the company's decision to make that change affects us in ways that, you know, are quite difficult to imagine.
Yeah, listening to your story, as you say, it's about your own personal experience there on the York Peninsula with telecommunications issues, but I feel like it is a story that would resonate and feel very familiar to people in regional areas right around the country.
Yeah, exactly.
So just, and we are going to hear your story in just a moment, but just talk us through a bit about, especially like say this last year, as a student, how difficult has it been for you with, you know, the 3G shutdown and having these issues of not being able to get good phone and internet reception. How's that affected you and your studies?
Oh, it's been pretty tough. I think the main factor that's been, I guess, you know, pretty annoying to me was the unreliability of it. Like one day it would be working fine, the next it just failed completely. There was one incident earlier in the year where my SSD on my laptop failed, and I lost probably a week's worth of work because I couldn't save it to OneDrive or anything. So yes, it's been tough, but I think we've managed to get through quite well.
Yeah, when you speak with others in the area, very similar experience with your other students and family members, that it is having a pretty significant impact?
Yeah, I've had a fair few complaints around the area so far, yeah.
Yeah. So what do you hope by getting your experience out there, you know, just a very everyday experience of these frustrations of trying to get connected in the country, what do you hope getting a story like yours out there will achieve?
I think it's just to show that sort of people in regional areas aren't isolated in these issues. Obviously, this has impacted so many people across Australia, and to know that other people have reached out and said, you know, hey, I've experienced this as well, is really quite powerful, I think.
Are you yourself, your studies, are they completed now? What's next for you?
Yeah, I've finished year 12 a couple of weeks ago, year 11 a couple of weeks ago, and then heading into year 12 next year.
And are you expecting that you are going to be sort of battling some of the same problems next year with your learning?
Yeah, probably.
Right.
Yeah, like not exactly wanting to go to Starlink. Well, we can, but it's just the price of, you know, being forced to pay for something when, you know, the everyone in the city can just, you know, get the regular MBN or something like that.
Mm. Now you're part of the Haywire experience, and that's coming in the year to come. So what are you hoping to and expecting to get out of this whole experience?
Well, I think probably new friendships, really. You know, I think all these opportunities are about meeting new people and discovering, you know, like-minded interests. So I think, yeah, definitely, you know, being able to head to Canberra and meet some amazing people from regional Australia would be great.
Because you, apart from Haywire and your studies, you know, you're on a few different committees and, you know, you're sort of out there quite involved in the community. What do you get out of, you know, putting yourself forward for things like this?
I think a lot of, I guess, confidence, particularly where I am now. I think growing up I was quite shy and was really afraid to speak up, but now I think, you know, putting yourself out there and, you know, sharing my story like this has been a, you know, a stepping stone.
Haywire, a new generation of storytellers.
Rhys, Sandilands, South Australia, Narunga Country.
I'm in the backyard of our farm, waving my phone around. It's impossible to get a tutor out here, so I'm trying to catch up online. But yet again, I can't get a simple web page to load. We've always had patchy internet on the farm, but since the 3G shutdown, things have gotten worse. I live in Sandylands, on the York Peninsula region in South Australia. There's not much out here besides a demolished church and some tennis courts, nestled in between a couple of durum and breadwheat paddocks. Dad's a farmer, and Mum works at one of the schools I go to in Maitland. There's a public school and a private school, and I'm a student at both. There's always been a rivalry between the schools, but for the first time, they've agreed to let students switch between campuses to help fill classrooms. It can be a bit tricky to navigate two timetables, but it means I can study subjects I'm interested in, like history and legal studies. My teachers tell me I'm driven. I guess I put my hand up for all sorts of things. I'm part of the South Australian Youth Forum, the South Australian Student Representative Council, and Movember's Youth Action Council, to name a few. It means I have to log in to lots of meetings after school. But our dicey internet makes that challenging. My connection dips in and out, and sometimes I can't join the call at all. I'll be halfway through a story before noticing everyone's frozen. I was over it, but our only option to improve our service was to pay hundreds for satellite. But why should living in the country mean having to pay more and settle for less? It didn't seem fair, so I decided to do something about it. I contacted the Federal Minister of Communications, Annika Wells. When I saw her reply, I felt energised. Although there wasn't a direct solution, I was grateful for the response. Even when I feel disconnected from the world, I can still be heard by people in power who live hundreds of kilometres away. It reinforced my dream of studying law or politics when I graduate. It'll be hard because I'll have to move to the city, but it'll be worth it. Even if I can't fix the internet for farming communities like mine, at least I can make sure they're heard.
abc.net.au/Haywire.
Rhys from Sandilands, one of our 2025 Haywire winners for South Australia. All the winners will be travelling to Canberra in January next year for the Haywire Regional Youth Summit. You can find out more and see other great stories by young regional Australians at abc.net.au/Haywire. And another chance to shout out our wonderful South Australian and Broken Hill winners, as we've already mentioned, but let's celebrate them again. Megan from Woodner, Vishwa from Renmark, Hannah Lee from Mount Gambier, and Geordie from Broken Hill are our South Australian and Broken Hill winners for this year. Maybe you could be one of the 2026 Haywire winners. So go and check out the website and find out more. It is 7 minutes away from the news.
The Country Hour, part of your community and your life.
It's nostalgic.
For 80 years.
Hanging out with my brothers in the back of a ute.
The Country Hour.
They just naturally grow a beautiful shape.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Dick Snedden of The Country Hour with a program for the farm families of Australia. Today, an irrigation expert gives us timely information on farm water supply. Then, following the national news at 12:30 Eastern Time, we give you weather forecasts in your particular district for the next 24 hours. These rural ingredients are blended for relaxed listening with the best of music from star pianist Dudley Stapleton, who now plays I Miss You So.
This is one of the earliest broadcasts of the Country Hour. Back in 1948, presented by Dick Snedden and with a live pianist in the studio. Bring that back, I say. Hello, I'm Annie Brown. This year, the Country Hour marks 80 years since it first went to air on ABC Radio on December 3rd, 1945. And if you've enjoyed listening to the Country Hour over those many years, then you probably owe a thank you to John Douglas. The Country Hour was his idea. John Douglas was an agricultural scientist who convinced ABC management during the time of World War II in the 1940s to establish a specialist rural department to broadcast information for farmers. John Douglas loved getting out and about with his microphone, recording the sounds and atmosphere of working on the land, a tradition still well and truly alive with current day rural reporters. Here is John Douglas in the shearing sheds in Woodstock, New South Wales, in 1946, the early days of the Country Hour.
There's a cry of Willoway. Yes, it's shearing time, as an old sheepman remarked. The war's over, appraisement's over. The first auction sales are over, and things look pretty good on the wool front. So the Country Hour takes you to see the golden fleece shorn from those with valuable sheep. Well, we're over on the shearing board, and it's a very typical shearing board, as most Australians know. The men are working on the rams. These Romneys are enormous sheep, these rams. They're bald-faced, they've got no horns, and they tell me that there's one here that's putting up a terrific struggle with the shearer, tearing the fleece about, and they've just been able to hold him, that he weighs about 240 pounds. These men, of course, get special rates for rams, and they look as though they're entitled to the way they're struggling here like a lot of league footballers. Let's go over and see the ringer of this shed. He's a young shearer here called Ted Fuller, who's just brought out a very big ram out of the pens. We'll have a yarn to him. Hello, Ted. How are you getting on?
Not too bad.
By the way, you've been right through this shed. What is your record cut here?
202.
They tell me that last year you got 234. Is that right?
Yes, I saw 234 last year. Mm.
Talking about records, doesn't Jack Howe hold the record as a shearer in Australia?
He holds the blade shearer's record.
How many?
328.
328 sheep in one day. Well, that's certainly going. Well, I hope there's a few old-time shearers listening to this noise. There's no need for me to tell you, of course, that this is hand shearing being done at Werribee on the stud rams. Ray Denzel, who is operating now on a very big stud Romney ram. Say, Ray, I see you've been in the army.
Oh, yes, I haven't. Not very long out of the army.
Where did you get to?
I was in Wewak with the 2nd 10 Commando Squadron.
Commando Squadron. Well, that's a very good training, you know, for a stud ram shearer, I can see.
Yes, you need it, too. You need every bit of it. More or less, it's leaves them with a better staple of wool for show purposes.
That's Ray Denzel speaking to John Douglas, the founder of the ABC's Rural Department in 1946, in the shearing sheds in Woodstock, New South Wales. Celebrating 80 years of rural stories on the Country Hour, I'm Annie Brown.
What a fantastic dip into history there. You're with Selena Green today, but that's all I've got time for really today on the Country Hour. It's coming up to the 1 o'clock news. I will be back on Friday, so there's no Country Hour tomorrow on New Year's Day, but I'll be back at noon for a usual one on Friday. I just want to say quickly that Cassie Huff and I have absolutely loved bringing you the Country Hour in 2025, especially knowing that we're coming up to celebrating our 80th birthday, which we officially did on the 3rd of December. Not just Cassie and I, but our wonderful team of rural reporters out there out in the regions, Isabella, Elsie, Jess, Eliza, Brooke, Catherine and Lily. And we can't wait to bring you the Country Hour again in 2026. We'll be here each day next year at noon. There will be a lot to cover off in 2026. Hopefully lots of positive news, news of a better season for everybody coming into the new year and an election year. So it'll be a busy one. Whatever you're getting up to this evening, maybe you're having a big one, maybe not so much because you've still got plenty of work to do. Whatever, we hope that you have a very safe and happy and wonderful New Year's and can't wait to be here on your radio in 2026. It's coming up to news time and 1 o'clock.
Where do you take the ABC Listen app?
Cooking and Barbie.
At the gym.
Up the creek.
Take ABC Local Radio with you wherever you go with the ABC Listen app.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.